It's 4 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ray Kugel reporting. Turkey evacuates tomb guards from Syria. Damascus is calling a Turkish military operation in northern Syria to evacuate dozens of troops and relocate a historically significant tomb, an act of flagrant aggression. The tomb and soldiers had been surrounded by Islamic State forces. Dorian Jones reports.
Hundreds of soldiers, supported by nearly 100 tanks and armored vehicles, along with fighter jets, crossed into Syria Saturday night. The force evacuated around 40 Turkish soldiers protecting an historic Ottoman tomb besieged by Islamic State forces for months. The remains of Suleiman Shah, grandfather of the founder of the Ottoman Empire, were removed and taken back to Turkey. Turkish Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu described the operation as a success. He said the Turkish forces have been given a directive to protect the country's spiritual values and the safety of armed forces personnel. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
The editor of a leading independent Russian newspaper says he plans this week to publish what purports to be an official Kremlin strategy document outlining Russia's 2014 invasion of Ukraine. Novaya Gazeta editor Dmitry Muratov says the document appears to have been prepared weeks before Ukraine's pro-Russian President Viktor Yanukovych was driven from office in February of 2014, following weeks of anti-government protests in Kiev. Two people were killed Sunday in a bomb blast in the Ukrainian-held city of Kharkiv as government supporters there and elsewhere marked the one-year anniversary of the overthrow of former President Yanukovych. Authorities say at least 10 others were wounded. This is VOA News. Militants loyal to the Islamic State group are claiming responsibility for bombing the empty residence of Iran's ambassador to Libya. No one was injured Sunday in the central Tripoli attack. A young girl killed herself and at least five others Sunday in the latest suicide bombing in the northeastern part of Nigeria, where government troops are battling insurgents from the Islamist extremist group Boko Haram. Witnesses described the girl as being no more than 8 years old and said she set off the bomb at a checkpoint in a market in Potiskum where phones are sold and repaired. There was no claim of responsibility for the explosion. Although U.S. Homeland Security officials say there is no credible threat against domestic shopping malls, the head of U.S. Homeland Security says authorities take a threat issued by the Somali-based militant group Al-Shabaab seriously. It is calling for Muslims to attack Western shopping malls, among them the Minnesota-based Mall of America. Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson, appearing Sunday on U.S. television, reacted to a video released by the Al-Shabaab terrorists.
We've seen this a number of times now where a group will call for an attack, and so we've got to be vigilant. So we ramp up security. There was a call for an attack on locations in Canada and Europe, and so in response to that, I ramped up the presence of the Federal Protective Service at federal buildings a couple of months ago. I'm sure that security at this particular mall will be enhanced in ways visible and not visible. But it also involves public vigilance and public awareness. If you see something, say something, has to be more than a slogan.
Secretary Johnson says such terrorist groups are making use of publications, videos, social media, and the Internet to publicize their messages and threats. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and his Iranian counterpart ended an almost two-hour meeting in Switzerland Sunday. The talks, which will resume today, Monday, are an attempt to reach a deal on Iran's nuclear program by a March 31st deadline. The round of discussions between the U.S. and Iran's top diplomats and energy officials is aimed at helping resolve ongoing technical disputes standing in the way of an agreement between Iran and the six world powers known as the P5+1. Greek leaders worked Sunday on a package of economic reforms to present to their European creditors as part of the agreement to extend the Athens bailout for 4 more months. The lenders gave Greece until today, Monday, to present proposals aimed at reviving the country's faltering economy and cutting government spending in exchange for renewing the almost $300 billion in loans set to expire this week. Nikos Pappas, the minister of state in a new leftist Greek government, said officials are working to make the government's civil service more effective and to combat tax evasion. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, February 23rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Liberia ends nationwide Ebola curfew.
We are seeing some light after the massive Ebola crisis here. And so the economy of the country has to restart. Kids have to go back to school. These are all activities that are moving towards normality.
Talba Nyeswa is Liberia's Assistant Minister of Health for Preventive Services. Somalia's security minister says a woman was involved in Friday's twin suicide bombings in Mogadishu. Campaigning for Sudan's April presidential elections begins tomorrow, Tuesday. And Congo's opposition says President Joseph Kabila must step down at the end of his term next year.
To see that we are ready, we have signed what we call the truth contract. What is our objective? Our objective is to consolidate democracy. Our objective is to respect the constitution. Our objective is Mr. Kabila must go.
Martin Fayulu is leader of the opposition Commitment for Citizenship and Development in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The U.S. Congress to debate funding for homeland security as Al-Shabaab threatens to attack the largest mall in the United States. And a novel HIV vaccine prevents disease in monkeys. Those stories plus Monk Old Man Sports and our Black History Month and African History Facts of the Day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Liberian Health Ministry official says the country will continue to observe all Ebola preventive protocols and regulations until it achieves zero infections. This comes as President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf on Sunday ordered the lifting of the Ebola curfew put in place nationwide since August in 2014 to prevent the further spread of the virus. Talba Nyeswa, Liberia's Assistant Minister of Health for Preventive Services and head of the country's Ebola response, says Liberia is returning to some normalcy in light of recent decline in the number of Ebola cases.
The fact of the matter is that we are seeing some light after the massive Ebola crisis here. We've seen some level of stability in the crisis. Things are improving, and so the economy of the country has to restart. Kids have to go back to school. The president has lifted the curfew, and so these are all activities that are moving towards normality.
Toward normality. So I'm reading that somewhere in Monrovia, there's an incident where someone at a hospital trying to infect people. Is Ebola still in Liberia?
Yes, Ebola is still in Liberia. Even if it is a single case, yes, Ebola is still in Liberia. But what we do know is that the cases have reduced dramatically. There's significant improvement in the response. Every single case that is reported in Liberia now is on the contact list. We've seen one or two cases per week in the past 2 weeks, 21 days. We've seen only 14 Ebola cases are compared to 70 to 100 cases in the month of August and September. So we are optimistic that we will get to zero soon with the level of work that we're doing here.
While there is a decline of Ebola in Liberia, in neighboring countries such as Sierra Leone, we see sometimes an uptake in Ebola. Now, by opening the borders, are you taking a risk?
Part of our response is cross-border surveillance. Our county health teams in Liberia, they are more vigilant with cross-border activities. All of our border counties have been freed of Ebola either in the last 35 to 42 days, including Grand Cape Mount, Bapolu, Lofa, Nimba. These counties bordering Sierra Leone and Guinea have been Ebola-free over 42 days now. So you're correct, but what we're doing here across Liberia is to strengthen, accelerate cross-border activities.
Schools in Liberia have reopened or are gradually reopening. Do you have everything in place for these schools?
We have everything in place in terms of Ebola prevention materials. We deliver Ebola prevention materials to 4,000-plus schools in Liberia, covering about 1 million population of school-going children. And these materials include the thermometers, the chlorine, the hand-washing equipment, buckets. These things have been delivered to about 4,000 schools. We continue to carry on assessment to make sure that the rest of the schools in Liberia get the materials.
Talbot Nyesua is Liberia's Assistant Minister of Health for Preventive Services. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. Two opposition officials in the Democratic Republic of Congo are calling on President Joseph Kabila to step down at the end of his term next year, saying the Constitution bars him from seeking a third term. President Kabila's spokesman, Lambert Mende, told VOA recently that Mr. Kabila has said he will respect the Constitution. Abo Moleka is a spokesman for the Opposition Union for Democracy and Social Progress, and Martin Fayulu is leader of the Commitment for Citizenship and Development. They both told me that President Kabila has been laying the groundwork to run for a third term.
I think since 2012, after the 2011 elections, it's been very clear that Kabila's camp was already envisaging a third term for him. Because you will remember that back in March, April 2012, the Secretary General of his party, the PPRD, Mr. Boshab, who is now the Interior Minister, went to Katanga and already tried to speak to the cell leaders into supporting a third term for Kabila. The second strategy that was more recent was to change the electoral law so that the presidential election would be conditioned by the holding of a census.
Let me say that we do speak a lot to the Minister of Information of the DRC, Lambert Mende. He continuously says that why is the opposition making this noise? Because President Kabila has not said that he wants to run again.
Yeah, but you have to ask Mr. Mende why they don't want to respect the Constitution, why they are making all this initiative to postpone the election. This is the question. But now they say that, okay, the prerequisite for having election is the census. Why? Because that census, they already called for the census in 2009, 5 years ago, they did it. Why they didn't organize the census at that time? Why today? We are saying no way. We are telling Mr. Kabila that he has to go according to the Constitution.
Let's assume that President Kabila decides today that I'm not seeking a third term. At the end of my term, I will give up. How ready is the opposition?
The first of all, to see that we are ready, we have signed what we call the truth contract. What is our objective? Our objective is to consolidate democracy. Our objective is to respect the Constitution. Our objective is Mr. Kabila must go. Secondly, we have put in place some principles and values that we, all of us, we have to respect. But to go straight to your question, we have to do things step by step. What is the step one? The step one is the prerequisite that we have to agree to make foundation. After having the foundation, then we go to the second step. If you start today saying that, oh, I'm candidate, you are candidate, we will start fighting. And then people from Kabila's side, they will come and divide us.
Albert, if you look around Africa these days, you notice that Africans are waking up. They are protesting. Each time they see their government is trying to maneuver with a constitution. We saw that in Burkina Faso. Now, the demonstrations, what is the intention of the opposition in the DRC?
I think what is most important is to grasp the message that the people have sent through these demonstrations. And the message was clearly, we don't want furthermore of a Kabila. That is the essence of the message.
That was Albo Moleka, spokesman for the Opposition Union for Democracy and Social Progress in the DRC. You also heard Martin Fayulu, leader of the Commitment for Citizenship and Development. They both spoke with me during a visit to our Washington studio. Campaigning for presidential and parliamentary elections in Sudan starts tomorrow, Tuesday. The elections themselves are scheduled for April 13 this year. President Omar al-Bashir, who has been in power since 1989, is seeking re-election. The National Electoral Commission has reportedly said 15 candidates will contest the presidency, although the country's major political parties are boycotting. Information Minister Ahmed Bilal says elections are a measure of democracy in every country and that the opposition parties that are boycotting are missing out.
I think everything is now completed and the parties which are participating, there are about 44 parties. They're joining the elections, and things are going very well, no problem. Of course, some of the opposition party are doing a boycott, and they are not going for the elections. They are free to suppress themselves, but the majority of the Sudanese, for sure, they are going for the election.
Exactly. I'm reading that there are 15 candidates who will stand for the presidency in addition to President Bashir. Your critics say that these 15 parties are a creation of President Bashir, and therefore the election is not going to be legitimate.
In fact, actually, I tell you something. We can say that all the opposition parties are just a decoration. They are just names without any sort of people with them. So it becomes some sort of allegation, this year an accusation, this year, see, and this year. Everybody knows that the only thing to be actually in the political game is elections.
Mr. Minister, President Barack Obama last week loosened on certain sanctions on your country. What does your government make of that?
I think this is actually quite a good step appreciated by our government. And for the first time, we feel that the American administration is serious about our government.
Ahmed Bilal is Sudan's information minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Khartoum. Today is Monday, February 23rd, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa. On The Voice of America, I'm James Butte in Washington. Still to come, Mark Oldman's Sports and our Black History Month and African History Facts of the Day. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. The Somali government said preliminary information gathered indicates a female suicide bomber was involved in Friday's twin explosions at a hotel in central Mogadishu, which killed 25 people and wounded more than 50 others. Security Minister Abdi Razak Omar Mohammed said the suspect woman worked at the hotel for 8 months after returning to Mogadishu from Europe.
We are still investigating the correct information on the figures, but death is estimated to be between 25 to 28. The injured over 54, and most of the injured, they are not major injuries, they are slight injuries. So we are expecting them to be out of the hospital within the next couple of days.
Mr. Minister, we're getting some information about the suspect, who she was, where she's from, and what was her job in the hotel.
The suspect, even though I cannot, due to the ongoing investigation, I cannot provide the exact country that she is from. She is from the diaspora. She was working in Somalia at that hotel for about 8 months now. She was the manager of the reception area of the hotel. It's still exchanging information with other international intelligence agencies until we are clear to release the name and the country that she originated. I can only confirm that she has come from the one of the European countries.
Can you tell us something more about her? Like, she was living in Mogadishu. What time she came back to Somalia?
I really don't know the exact date that she arrived in Mogadishu. But the information that we have is that she was a female. She came here with her husband, and her husband has died. She has been telling the guests of the hotel that he died because of malaria, but we don't know the exact cause of his death. She also had six small young kids.
Abdi Razak Omar Mohammed is Somalia's security minister. He was speaking with Falastin Iman of VOA's Somali service. After a week-long recess, the U.S. Congress gets back to work facing a deadline. Funding for domestic security operations, which expires at the end of this month. A Republican attempt to block President Barack Obama's executive actions on immigration has been a sticking point in authorizing new spending for the Department of Homeland Security. VOA's Michael Bowman reports from Washington.
Another day and another terrorist threat. This one from Africa-based Al-Shabaab, responsible for a deadly 2013 attack on a shopping mall in Kenya and now claiming to have Minnesota's Mall of America in its sights. The threat highlights the need to keep domestic security operations funded, according to Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson.
Why it's imperative that we have a budget for the Department of Homeland Security, which is due to expire at the end of the week.
For weeks, Democrats have blocked Senate consideration of a House-passed DHS bill that would block President Obama's executive order shielding millions of undocumented immigrants from deportation. Democrats and some Senate Republicans are calling for a clean funding bill with no strings attached. That is a non-starter, according to House Speaker John Boehner.
The House has done its job. We've passed the bill that funds the department and stops the president's unilateral actions with regard to immigration. It's up to Senate Democrats now to do their job.
But the firestorm over immigration could be tempered by last week's action by a federal court to put the president's executive action on hold. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham.
I am willing and ready to pass a DHS funding bill and let this play out in court. The worst possible outcome for this nation is to defund the Department of Homeland Security, given the multiple threats we face to our homeland.
Graham said Republicans who control both houses of Congress will be blamed if funding lapses and the United States suffers an attack. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. researchers are calling it a big deal. Next year, human clinical trials could begin on a novel AIDS treatment that alters DNA, turns cells into HIV fighters. The treatment has completely protected monkeys from a primate version of the immune disorder, VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
Researchers are engineering healthy muscle cells to induce them to crank out genetic instructions that could potentially neutralize HIV, the virus that causes AIDS in humans. Scientists at Scripps Research Institute use the technique to completely protect rhesus macaque monkeys, whose immune systems were repeatedly exposed to simian immunodeficiency virus, or SIV, a primate version of HIV. After treatment, Scripps researcher Michael Farzan says the macaques never became infected despite the challenge.
We continue to administer the virus, doubling the dose each time. We've now gone with six doses that were incapable of infecting control animals. We've gone to 16 times that.
The findings were reported in the journal Nature. Traditional vaccines train the immune system to recognize and destroy microbial invaders. But the experimental AIDS vaccines fail because the virus is continually changing its appearance to evade destruction. Farzan, the study's lead investigator, says the new approach tricks HIV into revealing a key viral surface protein. The compound targets the portion of the virus that's always mutating to avoid the immune system. Once found, a second protein makes the virus self-destruct, so it never has a chance to infect cells. The team wants to begin clinical trials in patients who cannot tolerate antiretroviral drugs. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Time now for Daybreak Africa. Sports here is Marco Woma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with football. FIFA Under-17 World Cup champions Nigeria, Guinea, Mali and South Africa advanced to the semi-finals at the Africa Under-17 Championships in Niamey, Niger over the weekend. They qualify for the FIFA Under-17 Championships later this year. On Sunday, Mali pipped defending champions Ivory Coast 1-0, which eliminates the Ivorians, as South Africa beat Cameroon 3-1. Earlier on Saturday, Nigeria beat tournament debutants Zambia 3-1 as Niger edged Guinea 2-1. Meanwhile, Algeria's Orange Africa Champions League title holders Entente Setif pipped Egypt's Orange Africa Confederations Cup champions El Ahly 6-5 in a post-match penalty shootout to win the Orange African Super Cup in Blida, some 50 kilometers southwest of the Algerian capital Algiers, on Saturday. The two sides were deadlocked at 1-1 at the end of open play. In cricket, India beat South Africa by 130 runs at the ICC Cricket World Cup in Melbourne, Australia, on Sunday. Turning to athletics, Ethiopian Endeshao Negese won the Tokyo Marathon in 2 hours 6 minutes in the Japanese capital on Sunday. Olympic marathon champion Stephen Kiprotich was second in a Uganda national record of 2 hours 6 minutes and 33 seconds. Kenyan defending champion Dickson Chumba finished 1 second behind Kiprotich. Meanwhile, Behanu Dibaba clocked 2 hours 23 minutes and 15 seconds to prevail in the women's race. Kenyan Hela Kipro was second as Ethiopian Olympic marathon champion Tiki Galana placed third. Elsewhere, Kenyan Lawrence Cherono triumphed at the Seville Marathon in Spain on Sunday. Finally, Somalia-born Mohamed Farah of Britain clocked 8 minutes and 3.40 seconds to set a world record in 2 miles at the IWF Indoor Permit meeting in Birmingham, Britain on Saturday. Farah was almost a second faster than the previous world best by Ethiopian Kenenisa Bekele in 2008. Other African winners in Birmingham were Kenyans Jeremiah Mutai and Vincent Kibet in the men's 800 meters and 1500 meters respectively. Ivory Coast's Muriel Ahore, Ethiopian Aksumawit Mbai and Tunisian Habiba Gribi carried the day in the women's 60 meters, 1 mile and 3000 meters respectively. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Time now for our Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 23rd. On this day in 1868, William Edward Beauregard Du Bois was born in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. His mother raised him on her own, instilling in him the values of hard work and education. His family was poor but respected. William did well in high school and got a scholarship to Fisk University. He also attended Harvard University and became the first African-American to get a doctoral degree from Harvard. One of Du Bois' achievements was the formation of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP. He also helped to educate America about the problems of black people, but some criticized him for speaking only for the educated. Du Bois became discouraged about what he called the American situation and took up citizenship in the West African country of Ghana in 1963. On August 27, that same year, Du Bois died in Ghana. On this day in 1895, former slave and diplomat William H. Hurd was named Minister Resident and Consul General to Liberia by President Grover Cleveland. Hurd was born into slavery in Elbert County, Georgia. While in Monrovia, Hurd also served as superintendent of the Liberia Annual Conference of the African Methodist Episcopal Church and built the first A&E church in Monrovia, the Eliza Turner Memorial Chapel. Yesterday, Sunday, 1950, basketball star Julius Winfield Irving was born in Hempstead, New York. His acrobatic moves on the court won him the nickname Dr. J. His career as an NBA player began in 1976 with the Philadelphia 76ers and lasted until 1987. During that time, Dr. J led the 76ers to the NBA Finals 4 times and won the championship in 1983. He was also an All-NBA first-team selection 5 times and averaged about 22 points per game. Those are your Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 23rd. Congratulations to Ma Botswana Mzingwani of Orapa in Botswana, Abdullahi Bala of Jamaica Yola in Nigeria, and George Tembe of Peace Island in Monrovia, Liberia. You are the winners of our February 20th question. Who were the Tuskegee Airmen? The answer, they were black servicemen of the U.S. Air Force created at the Tuskegee Institute in Alabama. Now here is our question for today, February 23rd. Who is the 19th century inventor known also as the Black Thomas Edison? Once again, who is the 19th century inventor known also as the Black Thomas Edison? Send your answers to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. Remember to include your mailing address. That's it for this Monday, February 23rd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotin and Ricky Shryak, as well as sports editor Marco Oman, along with our engineer Aideen Uku, I'm James Butte in Washington, hoping that you make this week a very, very productive one.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, Burundi President Pierre Nkurunziza is bidding for a third term in June's election. We'll discuss why the move is stirring controversy. That's next time on VOA Africa.